his overcoat over his knees. Windows lined one wall of the corridor, allowing Brunetti to look across to the other wing of the ex-monastery. The top fronds of an enormous palm tree were visible on the far side of the courtyard, and behind them the windows of a matching corridor. Did similar trouble, equal pain, fill that other place? Brunetti wondered. Did the people there look across and ask the same questions, trick themselves into believing their trouble would be less if it were worse on the other side? And how to measure trouble? How to measure pain? He turned in the chair to take a quick look up and down the hall. He and the motionless man were the only people there. Brunetti got to his feet and walked to the side of the bed. The man lay still, his hands outside the covers, clear fluid slowly dripping into a needle stuck in the back of his right hand. Brunetti bent his knees and leaned closer to the man, bracing himself on the bed with one hand. Just below the left cuff of the hospital gown, Brunetti saw three small, moon-like indentations on the inside of his wrist. Because the bed was pressed against the wall, Brunetti was prevented from moving around it to see if there was a similar set of marks on his other wrist. Brunetti went back to the chair and sat. He propped his feet on the low railing at the foot of the bed. He crossed his legs and studied the crucifix on the wall. Did people still think he could help them? Maybe being in the hospital refreshed their belief and made it possible again for them to think that he would. One gentleman to another, Brunetti asked the man on the cross if he would be kind enough to help the man in the bed. He was lying there, perhaps troubled in spirit, helpless, wounded and hurt, apparently through no fault of his own. It occurred to Brunetti that much the same could be said of the man he was asking to help. This would perhaps make him more amenable to the request. As he considered that possibility, Brunetti became aware of a shape at the side of the bed. The woman's sudden presence forced him free of his reverie, and he stood and draped his coat over the railing at the bottom of the bed. Professoressa Crosera didn't acknowledge him. She walked to the side of the bed, looked at the man, and stood as if paralyzed. She raised a hand and touched her husband's upper arm, then removed it and bowed to kiss him on the forehead. The man lay still, unresponsive. Hesitantly she touched his cheek, his lips, then pulled her hand back and tightened it into a fist. The man's chest rose and fell, but the ambient noise covered any sound his breathing might have made. Brunetti crossed his arms but said nothing. She glanced toward the motion and looked at him for no longer than it would take her eyes to photograph him, her face completely free of expression. She turned back to her husband and said,
"Tell me what happened."
"Your husband was found earlier this morning at the foot of a bridge. He may have fallen, though the doctor who admitted him found marks on his body that suggest he may have been pushed down the bridge."
"May have been," she repeated.
"Yes, signora."
"You're not sure?"
"There were no witnesses that we know of," Brunetti explained.
When she did not react, he carried the chair over to the side of the bed.
"Please, signora," he said, "take this."
At first it seemed she didn't know what to do, but then she sank into the chair, and kept sinking lower in it so quickly that Brunetti feared she would fall off onto the floor. He acted instinctively, putting his hand on the front of her shoulder and pushing her back in the chair. Her eyes closed for a moment, and when she opened them her astonishment was raw, as though she'd fallen asleep on a bus and been awoken by the unsolicited attentions of a stranger.
"Are you all right, signora?" Brunetti asked, stepping away from her. "Should I call the nurse?"
She relaxed at the sincerity of his concern, closed her eyes again and shook her head minimally.
"No. No, I just need a moment."
Hearing footsteps approaching, Brunetti turned, and a nurse he had not seen before walked past quickly, ignoring them both. She disappeared into a room at the end of the hall. Then, from behind him, he heard the clank of the arriving breakfast cart. Brunetti stood motionless, waiting for the professoressa to regain her composure. She was thinner than he remembered her being. He had only felt bone when he'd tried to prop her up. She looked at him, and he saw that, like Grifoni's, her face was drawn and tired. But hers looked as if it had grown that way over a longer period of time. She wore no lipstick, and her lips looked so dry he wanted to offer her a glass of water. She started to speak, gave a small cough, and tried again.
"What have the doctors done?"
she asked, then turned her head in the direction of the cart as it slammed into the wall and set dishes and glasses rattling. The noise jolted her to her feet, and she shot a quick glance to her husband, who had not moved.
"They took x-rays when he was brought in, but there was no neurologist on call last night. I don't know what they plan for today."
"You said he fell,"
she said.
"Yes, Ponte del Forner, over by—"
"I know where it is,"
she said. Then, voice growing harsh, she demanded,
"What's wrong with him?"
Brunetti stopped himself from looking at the supine man, silent as these two people discussed what had happened to him as if he were not there.
"I'm sorry, Professoressa, but I know only what the doctor told my colleague this morning when he was admitted."
After a long time, she said,
"Our apartment is near the bridge."
"Is it?"
Brunetti asked, seeing no reason to reveal that he had already begun to look into their lives. Instead, he asked,
"Did you know that your husband had gone out?"
She hesitated for some time before she answered this.
"No."
"Did he seem troubled in any way?" Brunetti asked.
"Troubled?"
she asked, as if responding to a word in a foreign language, but finally said,
"No,"
and quickly added,
"other than about our son."
Brunetti nodded, quite as if he believed her.
"You didn't hear the phone ring or anyone come to the house?"
he asked, trying to sound as though he were reciting a list from memory and really had little interest in her answers.
"No. People don't come to your house at midnight, do they?"
she asked, suggesting she found it a silly question. Ignoring her reference to the time when the incident probably took place, Brunetti changed tactics and tone.
"Did you tell him you came to talk to me last week?"
She took even longer to answer this, and finally said,
"Yes."
She looked at him, and he saw that her eyes were in fact darker than her hair, the pupil seeming of one color with the iris.
"What did he say to that?"
"When I told him how little you could do, he told me I'd been wasting my time,"
she said, though she seemed embarrassed to say it. At that moment the metal breakfast cart, pushed by two white-uniformed attendants, clacked towards them. Brunetti moved to the end of the bed and backed up against the wall. Professoressa Crosera, he realized he hadn't asked her for her husband's name, moved to stand against the wall at the head, both of them doing their best to avoid collision with the cart. Brunetti waited to see whether the attendants would bang the cart into the wall to spite them for being there for so long while they were trying to work. Instead, they slowed their progress and stopped short of the bed. Each slid a metal tray from the cart as quietly as they could and took them into the room on their right. They emerged and, excusing themselves to Professoressa Crosera, delivered breakfast to the next room, and so all the way down to the end of the hallway. When all the trays had been distributed, they pushed the empty cart against the wall and walked back past Brunetti and Professoressa Crosera and out into the waiting area, nodding to both of them as they passed. "Did they speculate," Brunetti asked himself, "about the personal configurations clustered around the beds of the patients? Did they hear things that should not be said, tones that should not be used when speaking to a sick person?"
"When will a doctor come?"
Professoressa Crosera asked Brunetti, just as if she thought he'd know. She touched the corner of her husband's mouth.
"Can he have water?" she asked.
"I think that's taken care of," Brunetti suggested, pointing to the drip of clear liquid that stood beside the bed, the needle taped to the back of her husband's hand.
Brunetti turned to the sound of footsteps approaching. The older of the two uniformed attendants approached them with a tray holding two plastic cups and two plastic-wrapped brioche. Since they were both still standing, the attendant set it on the chair at the foot of the bed, saying gently,
"You should have something to eat. It will help."
That broke her. Professoressa Crosera gave a great heaving sob. She covered her mouth with her hand and walked to the far end of the corridor. Brunetti and the attendant could hear her sobs. Both turned away to face the door to the waiting area.
"Thank you, signora," Brunetti said. "You're very kind."
She was a robust woman. Stuffed into a uniform, she seemed to be outgrowing. One loose strand of graying hair had slipped from under the transparent plastic shower cap thing. Her hands were red and rough. She smiled. St. Augustine was wrong, Brunetti realized. It was not necessary for grace to be arrived at by prayer. It was as natural and abundant as the sunlight.
"Thank you," he said, smiling back at her.
"I'll be getting on with my work, then," she said, speaking Veneziano.
She left him and went back down the corridor. Brunetti picked up one of the coffees and went to stand in front of the window to drink it. He heard the woman's footsteps as she came back to the bed, heard the rough sound of the sugar envelope being opened. Down in the courtyard, a gardener stood with a hose in one hand, a cigarette in the other, letting water flow into the ground around the trunk of the palm tree. Brunetti went to the chair and set his empty cup on the tray. The brioche was probably more chemical than flour, but still Brunetti ate it, refusing to let himself taste it. Luckily, the woman had also brought two cups of water, one of which he drank as soon as the brioche was gone.
"Would you like me to go and see if anything is happening?" Brunetti asked.
"Yes, please,"
Professoressa Crosera said. A different nurse was behind the desk now, a woman in her 50s with very thick graying hair cut short. He showed her his warrant card to let her see his rank, though he had no idea if it would help. Apparently it did, because she looked at him after seeing it and asked,
"How can I help you, commissario?"
"I'm here because of the man who was brought in this morning with a head injury. Do you have any idea of when he'll be seen by a neurologist?"
She glanced at her watch.
"Dottor Stampini, the chief neurologist, is always in his office by 7, signore. The injured man's x-rays are on his desk."
Then she said in a professionally neutral voice,
"The night nurse told me she took them down to Dottor Stampini's office herself. Will that be all?" she asked.
"Thank you, signora," Brunetti answered. "His wife is here. I'll go and tell her."
Dottor Stampini arrived at the bedside about 15 minutes later. He was a surprisingly youthful man with a shock of reddish-blonde hair that he occasionally tossed back from above his eyes, the way a horse tosses its mane. He shook hands with Professoressa Crosera and then with Brunetti, gave his name but made no attempt to discover who they were, and asked them to move away from the bed while he examined his patient. Brunetti moved a few meters down the corridor. She chose to stand at the nearest window and look out into the courtyard. Brunetti kept his eyes on the doctor. Dottor Stampini took a small flashlight from the pocket of his white jacket and bent over the man on the bed. He raised the man's right eyelid, shone the light into it, and then did the same with the left. He then moved towards the bottom of the bed, folded back the covers, and exposed both legs to the knees. He took a small metal hammer from the same pocket and tapped at the right knee, repeated the blow a number of times, then tried the left knee with the same lack of success. He replaced the covers and took up the chart that hung from the bottom of the bed. He read the first and second page, then held an X-ray up to the light coming in from the window behind Brunetti. He put it back and wrote on the chart, replaced it, then picked it up again and added something. When he was finished, he came down towards them.
"Are you his wife, Signora?"
the doctor asked as he reached them.
"Yes. What's wrong with him?"
"One moment,"
the doctor said, turning to Brunetti.
"And you are?"
"Commissario Guido Brunetti, Polizia di Stato."
The doctor made no attempt to hide his surprise.
"May I ask why you're here, Commissario?"
"My colleague told me that the doctor who admitted the patient to the hospital said he noticed marks on his wrist."
The doctor turned and went back to the bed. Brunetti watched him examine first the left wrist, then the right, careful not to disturb the needle in the back of the hand. Then he went to the foot of the bed and wrote on the chart for some time.
"What marks?"
Professoressa Crosera asked Brunetti while they watched the doctor.
"What from?"
Brunetti thought she sounded frightened.
"I don't know, Signora. Do you have any idea?"
Her eyes widened at Brunetti's question. As the doctor approached, she shook her head but said nothing. This time Dottor Stampini addressed Professoressa Crosera, ignoring Brunetti.
"I've ordered the CAT scan. When I have the results, I'll have a clearer idea of what's going on."
"Isn't there anything you can tell me, even without the scan?"
she asked, managing to keep her voice calm. The doctor shrugged and flipped his hair off his face again.
"Not really, Signora. I'm sorry, but nothing will be clear until I see the scan."
"This morning?"
she asked, this time failing to keep the fear from her voice.
"Sometime today."
"Thank you, dottore," Brunetti said,
as if the doctor had been speaking to both of them, then asked,
"You saw them?"
Suddenly impatient, the doctor said,
"The skin is broken. It could be anything."
Brunetti nodded, and the doctor continued.
"If you have no more questions, I'll begin my rounds."
"Thank you, dottore," Brunetti said.
Then, as if he'd just thought of it, he said to Professoressa Crosera,
"I have to call the questura. I'll do it from the waiting room. The connection here is bad."
The doctor took this opportunity to leave and started down the corridor, Brunetti close behind him, his telefonino in his hand. When they were almost at the stairway, Brunetti put the phone in his pocket and called to the man in front of him,
"Dottor Stampini."
Stampini stopped and turned. With little patience, he asked,
"What is it?"
Putting on his most amiable voice, Brunetti said,
"I'd like to have a word with you, if you have time."
Neither of them could ignore how close they were to the nurses at the desk, and so Stampini said,
"All right, we can use my office."
It was the second on the left, and looked much like the office of every other overworked doctor Brunetti had ever seen. Books and folders on the desk, open drawers spilling out sample boxes of medicine, back issues of medical journals stacked on the radiators, a disorderly row of cups on the windowsill. Stampini stopped just inside the door and again asked,
"What is it?"
With no hesitation, Brunetti said,
"His pupils don't dilate, and he's lost the reflexes in his knees. That suggests something serious, doesn't it?"
Stampini's response was similarly direct.
"Are you a doctor in your spare time, commissario?"
"No, dottore, I'm not. And believe me, I don't pretend to be. But I've seen a lot of injured people in my career. Too many of them, I'm afraid. And the ones with these symptoms are often..."
He broke off and waited for the doctor to say something. When he did not, Brunetti concluded,
"I don't presume to tell you something you know far better and in far greater detail than I do, dottore."
Stampini considered Brunetti's conciliatory remark and asked,
"What is it you want to know?"
"If I proceed on the assumption that the marks on his wrist are signs of violence or some sort of attack, I have to organize a criminal investigation and try to find someone who might have seen him before it happened."
I see," the doctor said.
Then, in a milder voice, he asked,
"What happened?"
"We aren't sure.
He was found lying at the foot of a bridge. When he fell, he hit his head on the metal railing and on the pavement. There was blood in both places."
"And the marks on his wrist?"
Dottor Stampini asked.
"Like you, dottore,"
Brunetti answered with a small smile.
"I see injuries and I try to draw conclusions. In this case, it could be simple. Someone attacked him and pulled him off balance."
"Was he robbed?"
the doctor asked.
"He didn't have his wallet on him. He had the keys to his house in his pocket, and he wasn't wearing a coat. He lives not far from where he was found."
"The chart says he was x-rayed at 3 this morning."
Brunetti nodded.
"He was attacked sometime around midnight."
Stampini stuffed his hands into the pockets of his jacket and stared at the floor. He rocked back and forth on the balls of his feet for a while, and then pulled his hands out and shoved his hair back from his forehead. Finally, he said,
"He's not going to be able to tell you what happened. Not soon. And perhaps not ever."
"The x-rays?" Brunetti asked.
Stampini nodded.
"There appears to be a great deal of hemorrhaging. The CAT scan will tell me more, but what I can see from the x-rays doesn't look good."
"Good in what sense, dottore? For his full mental recovery?"
Brunetti asked.
"Or for his survival?"
Dottor Stampini's expression told Brunetti little. The doctor's right hand rose to his chin, and he pushed at the skin of his cheek, as though trying to check whether he'd remembered to shave that morning. The doctor lowered his hand and looked across at Brunetti.
"Both,"
he said. But then he must have thought back over the tangled grammar of Brunetti's question, for he quickly changed it to,
"Neither."
"I don't understand," Brunetti admitted.
"Nothing looks good,"
Dottor Stampini said, then,
"Don't tell his wife."
"I don't have to, dottore. She'll find out soon enough."
Chapter 9. Realizing that there was nothing else to say, Brunetti took a step back and prepared to leave the office. The younger man made a hesitant noise, then said,
"Of course I could be wrong. There have been cases where the blood is reabsorbed and the patient recovers fully."
Brunetti raised a hand and let it fall back. He could think of nothing at all to say, and so left to return to Professoressa Crosera and her husband. When Brunetti entered the corridor, he saw two male attendants, one at the head and the other at the foot of the injured man's bed, his wife standing nearby. Brunetti remained where he was and waited to see what would happen. The men began to roll the bed towards the door, past him, then out to the elevators. Brunetti and Professoressa Crosera followed them silently into the elevator. No one spoke while it descended. On the second floor, the men rolled the stretcher into Neurologia. One of them gave some papers to the nurse at the desk, who glanced through them and said something to him, then pushed a button on the wall, and the doors to a corridor pulled back, allowing the men to roll the stretcher inside. When Brunetti and Professoressa Crosera attempted to follow, the nurse held up a hand and said,
"You can't go in there. I'm his wife."
This failed to have any effect on the nurse, who repeated,
"You can't go in there."
Then, relenting a bit, she added,
"Not until they've got him settled in a bed."
"Is there some place we can sit?" Brunetti asked,
eager to get back to the Questura, but unwilling to leave the woman until she had seen her husband settled. He glanced at his watch with no idea what it would tell him. It could still be 7, though it might as easily have been noon. He had been there so long that the numbers no longer separated or marked events. It turned out to be only a little after 9.
"There's a waiting room on the other side of the elevators,"
the nurse said, and picked up her phone. The usual red plastic chairs, forged together into lines of 5, awaited them. Always this terrible reddish-orange. Brunetti could not associate that color with anything other than suffering. He stood until Professoressa Crosera took a seat at the end of the row nearest to the door, then, leaving the seat empty where she had placed, not unintentionally, her bag, Brunetti took the next one.
"Could I ask you some questions, Professoressa?"
"You've already asked me some,"
she said, eyes on the door.
"I know that, and I apologize for troubling you. But if the signs that your husband was attacked are confirmed, then a crime was committed, and it's my job to find the person responsible. The only way I can do that is to have a closer look at your husband's recent behavior, to learn if anything unusual happened to him, or if anything he said or did might lead to the person who did this to him."
She listened in silence.
"Were there any unexplained phone calls? Subjects he seemed reluctant to discuss? People he didn't want to talk to? Maybe because of trouble with your son?"
In the face of her continuing silence, Brunetti went on.
"You said you were worried about your son. Your husband must have been as well."
"Wouldn't you be?"
she asked angrily.
"Any father would be, signora," Brunetti answered mildly, and then added, "and any mother."
He realized he had unconsciously stopped using her title, and addressed her as he would any woman. She turned away from him and pushed back in her chair, looking at the open doorway.
"As I told you, I have 2 children, both teenagers. I'm never free of worrying about them and what might happen to them."
Not bothering to look at him, she asked in a polite, social voice,
"Is this something they teach you in police school, Commissario? How to earn the trust of the people you're questioning?"
Her question insulted him, but it did not offend him. He couldn't, however, resist the luxury of laughter, which surprised her.
"No, signora," he said when he stopped. "We were taught to try to bond with the men we questioned by talking about football. When I entered the police, no one thought we'd ever have to question a woman. I suspect our teachers believed they'd all be at home, taking care of the kids."
He straightened his face and said,
"I want to find the person who did this to their father, and I'm asking for your help."
She turned back to him to ask,
"Even if what I say might endanger my son?"
"Your son is too young to be in any legal danger. The worst that could happen to him is that he'd be sent to speak to a social worker or psychologist, but only if the judge declared him sufficiently dependent on drugs to need professional help."
She turned away again and studied the door.
"But what if what I told you put my son in greater danger?"
she asked. Brunetti examined her words. Greater danger. Greater than the danger his father had been put in? Greater danger than he was in now, presumably because the dealer had somehow found out that his mother had gone to the police? Had her husband decided to confront him, and was it the dealer who had met him on the bridge?
"Are you afraid of the person who's selling him the drugs?" Brunetti asked.
She turned to face him.
"Only if the police fail to do anything about him, commissario."
Before Brunetti could protest that she was exaggerating, she went on.
"No matter what you do, the dealers will be free to do what they want."
"Did your husband speak to Sandro?"
Brunetti asked, unwilling to discuss what the police could and could not do. His question surprised her, and he watched as she tried to think of how to answer it.
"I can't tell you that,"
she finally answered, and again Brunetti was left with two ways to interpret what she said.
"Nothing we do to the dealer will put your son in jeopardy," Brunetti insisted.
"If he attacked my husband and you arrest him the day after?"
"Not if he's arrested for selling drugs. I'm sure your son isn't the only person he sells them to."
She laced her fingers together.
"I need time to think," she said. "I have to ask my husband."
Brunetti kept his face neutral and said only,
"He might not remember what happened."
That was certainly true of head injuries, Brunetti knew.
"No,"
she said in a voice grown solid with decision.
"I want to ask him."
Brunetti recognized that it was futile to insist, just as it was futile for her to think of asking her husband anything. He got to his feet and said, not without embarrassment,
"I'm sorry, but I don't know your husband's name."
She looked at him, startled, then cast a look of such yearning tenderness towards the ward where her husband had been taken that Brunetti turned his eyes away from her face.
"How strange,"
she said slowly. Brunetti returned his attention to her.
"Excuse me?" he asked. "I'm afraid I don't understand."
She smiled her first real smile. It wiped years from her face.
"It's usually the woman who is the nameless appendage to her husband."
Her face suddenly tightened, and she drew her lips together. Brunetti feared she would begin to cry again. Instead, she took a breath and said,
"Tullio Gasparini."
He thanked her and left, wondering, as he often did, if he would ever understand the secrets of the heart. Chapter 10 On his way to the Questura, Brunetti thought the first thing they had to do was find the man who was selling drugs to the students of the Albertini, Sandro Gasparini among them. For the moment, he was the most likely suspect in the attack. The simplest way to find him was to talk to the boy, but that would require the consent of the mother, who would surely insist that a lawyer be present. If she absolutely refused, they could have the boy followed. But where would he find the manpower for that, or a magistrate to authorize it? Why would a man be out on the street around midnight, coatless, with only his keys? Could he have left his home with no one noticing? Brunetti stopped in his tracks. Where had the boy been last night and this morning? He thought back over his conversation with Professoressa Crosera and could not remember asking her that. She had been at home when Brunetti called. If her son had been missing, surely that would have been the first thing she'd ask any policeman. When she went to the hospital before dawn, would she leave her home without explaining to the children where she was going? Had they both been there to tell? He pulled out the new phone Signorina Elettra had procured for him, went online, not without difficulty, and found the number of the Albertini and keyed it in. The phone rang four times before a woman answered.
"Good morning. This is the Albertini school. How may I help you?"
"Good morning, signora. This is Commissario Guido Brunetti. I'm calling about one of your students.
After some moments, she asked,
Commissario of Police?
As if other kinds of commissari were in the habit of phoning.
Yes. May I speak to the director?
This silence was longer, the result either of confusion or of reluctance.
One moment, please,
she finally said.
I'll pass you to Signora Direttrice Rallo.
The director answered on the second ring.
Bianca Rallo,
she said.
Signora Direttrice, Brunetti began. This is Commissario Guido Brunetti. I've called to ask about one of your students.
I don't mean to be impertinent,
she began in a well-educated voice.
But what assurance can you give me that you are who you say you are?
She was distant, polite, almost ironic.
Signora Direttrice, Brunetti answered with equal politeness. May I suggest a way around your doubts, if I might?
By all means.
Allow me to ask my question, and then call the Questura and ask to speak to Commissario Grifoni. You can give the answer to her.
He allowed her to digest this, then added,
I'll need a few minutes to call them and tell them to put you through to her immediately.
After a shorter pause, he asked,
Would this be acceptable, Signora Direttrice?
It depends on what your question is,
she answered in a pleasant voice.
We believe the father of two of your students, Tullio Gasparini, may have been attacked on the street last night. I'd like to know if Sandro came to school this morning.
That's all?
Yes.
Her silence drifted out from the telefonino. Brunetti looked at the water in the canal beside him and saw how high it was.
All right,
she answered.
I'll call them in 5 minutes.
Wasting no time, Brunetti ended their call, dialed the central number of the Questura, and asked if Grifoni had come in yet. When he heard that she had, he told the operator that there'd soon be a call for her from a Signora Rallo. The operator was to phone Commissario Grifoni immediately and tell her to expect the call. He put his phone back in his pocket and continued towards the Questura. When he got there 10 minutes later, he asked for Vianello, but was told that the inspector had come in but had been sent to Marghera to sit in on the questioning of a suspect in a case of domestic violence and wasn't expected to be back that day. Brunetti went to Grifoni's office. He noticed that she now wore a black skirt and jacket and had changed the telltale brown shoes.
"What happened?"
she asked when he came in. Rather than answer her question, Brunetti asked his own.
Did she call?
Who?
The preside of the Albertini, to tell you whether the son was at school today.
No.
When all Brunetti did was nod, Grifoni stood to reach over her desk to pull the second chair closer.
Sit down, for heaven's sake, Guido, and tell me what happened.
Brunetti obeyed and told her about his conversation with Professoressa Crosera and what had happened in the hospital after Grifoni left. Her office was so small that their knees were close to touching under her desk, even though he was half sitting in the doorway.
She was stunned by it. She collapsed when she saw him.
Real collapse or fake collapse?
She asked.
Real, I think.
Did she know he had gone out?
She said she didn't, but I don't believe her.
Grifoni, no stranger to lies, merely nodded.
What about her son? Was he there when you called her?
I don't know.
With some embarrassment, Brunetti added,
I didn't think to ask her.
Grifoni smiled.
Hence the phone call from the preside.
After a brief pause, she added,
Good for her. You could have been anyone. A kidnapper.
Claudia, Brunetti said, reaching across to tap the back of her hand with his index finger. We are in Venice. We are not in...
His voice trailed off. He thought for a moment and said,
Imagine that. I can't name a city where there's been a kidnapping in the last few years.
She looked at him and quickly looked away. After time for reflection, she said, her surprise audible,
I can't either. It's as if it's gone out of fashion.
Brunetti had reservations about that.
It's more likely that people don't report it anymore. Just pay and hope it works.
But we'd hear, wouldn't we,
sooner or later? She asked.
I suppose so, Brunetti admitted, and, taken aback by his own savagery, added, I hate it, more than any other crime, and I hate them.
More than murderers?
She asked.
In a way.
Why?
Because it replaces life with money, or because they trade life for money.
He failed to control the severity of his voice.
I've never heard you like this, she said.
I know. It's worse than anything. I'd put them all in jail forever, the kidnappers. Anyone who helped them, too. If they knew what they were going to do and still helped them, even if it was only to give them a postage stamp so they could mail the ransom note, I'd put them in jail for the rest of their lives.
By an act of great force of will, Brunetti stopped himself from saying more.
You worked on a case? Grifoni asked.
Yes. One of my first, more than 20 years ago.
Bad.
They took the daughter of a family from Naples.
Where did it happen?
Sardinia. It was when I was stationed in Naples. 3 of us were sent.
Did you find them?
Yes, Brunetti said gruffly.
How?
Brunetti waved this away with one hand.
They were stupid.
But?
She asked in response to something unspoken.
But the girl died.
Did they kill her before they got the ransom?
I sometimes wish they had, he answered.
Grifoni did not prod him, but Brunetti still explained.
They buried her in a box. When the police arrested them, there were 4 of them, they told them where the box was, but by the time they dug it up she was dead.
Grifoni said nothing.
Can we talk about something else, Claudia?
Before she could answer, her phone rang.
Grifoni,
she said. She raised a hand to Brunetti, nodding as she did.
Yes, he told me, signora.
Then, after a pause,
No, we're more or less equal, only he's been here longer than I have. Yes, he is. Originally from Castello, I think.
She looked at Brunetti, put her head back, and closed her eyes, using her right hand to make rolling waves in the air as she listened.
Yes, he's told me about the incident. He was in the hospital with the man this morning.
Grifoni covered her eyes with one hand, something she did when impatient.
Of course, I understand, Signora Direttrice.
Then Grifoni was silent for a long time. She moved her hand to the top of her head without opening her eyes, as if she wanted to keep the lid on, and continued to listen, letting loose an occasional murmur of agreement. Finally she removed her hand, saying,
He's there.
She opened her eyes and glanced at Brunetti, let out a neutral,
Mm-hmm,
and said,
Thank you, Signora Direttrice.
Then, slipping into that particular descending cadence used to end a conversation, she said,
I'm sure my colleague will be very grateful to learn this.
A few more polite noises, and then she hung up the phone.
As you heard, he's there. The school policy is to contact the parents immediately if a student fails to arrive for classes.
In a different, more curious voice, she said,
What do you know about the boy?
Only what I've told you.
15?
second year of liceo, troubled, not doing well in school.
And using drugs,
Grifoni supplied. His mother was convinced enough to come and see me.
Grifoni, whose office did not have a window, went and stood with her back against the wall, arms folded.
"Do you think the attack was the result?"
she asked, and Brunetti realized he was relieved that she did not question that it had been an attack.
"The two things are related in time," Brunetti said. "What I want to do is find something that leads from one to the other."
Grifoni, following the path between the two events, said,
"If Gasparini already knew who the dealer was but didn't want to involve us, he could have approached him or threatened him somehow."
Brunetti nodded. He'd already been down that path.
"We know who some of the dealers are, the ones at the schools," he said. "I know the names of at least two."
Grifoni nodded to show that she perhaps knew other names.
"One of them owes me a favor," Brunetti began. "It's time to call it in now."
Grifoni remained as she was, giving no sign of impatience or curiosity. She looked across at Brunetti as if it were quite normal for a man to sit in a chair in the middle of her doorway, its two back legs in the hallway, while she stood with her back against the wall and looked at him. Brunetti heard someone walk by in the corridor behind him, but did not turn around. When the footsteps disappeared, he finally said,
"I'll ask him who's in charge at the Albertini."
He was struck by how casual he had made it sound, as if a dealer had a license to sell drugs to the students at the school.
"Will he tell you?"
Grifoni asked.
Brunetti nodded. "A long time ago, my brother wrote a letter of recommendation for his son, who was applying for medical school in England."
"Medical school?"
she asked.
"Radiology. My brother's chief technician at the hospital in Mestre. The boy worked with him for 2 years. He said he was the best assistant he ever had. Why shouldn't he write him a reference?"
"Indeed,"
Grifoni agreed.
"What happened?"
"He's assistant chief radiologist in a hospital in Birmingham."
"And the father pushes drugs?"
Grifoni asked in bewilderment.
"And the father pushes drugs."
"Evviva l'Italia,"
Grifoni said. Chapter 11. They remained like that, in easy companionship, for a while, until Brunetti got to his feet and moved the chair back to its usual place against the wall, where, instead of blocking the door, it now blocked any attempt Grifoni might make to reach her desk from the right. He paused at the door, but before he could speak, Grifoni asked,
"And when your informant gives you his name?"
"I'll have a word with him."
"When you do, would you like me to come along?"
she asked. He had thought of taking Vianello. Grifoni was certainly very good at playing the role of good cop. She could suggest with a glance that she disagreed with Brunetti, could ask him a question in such a way as to show solidarity with the person who was being questioned, and could, upon occasion, oppose Brunetti's decisions or conclusions in such a way as to show the suspect that she was completely persuaded by the story he or she was telling. But she was a woman, and a man who dealt drugs would better be visited by a man.
"Thanks for offering, Claudia," he said. "It's always a joy to work with a person as cold-blooded as you can be, but in these circumstances I think it would be better if I went alone."
She smiled.
"To be called cold-blooded is a compliment any woman would be pleased to have, Guido."
He went back to his own office, again amazed that she tolerated the shoebox which Lieutenant Scarpa had somehow persuaded Vice Questore Patta to assign her. In Patta's defense, Brunetti imagined only that the Vice Questore had never considered it sufficiently important to climb the steps to take a look at her office, and thus had no idea what 6 square meters looked like, or what remained after a desk and 2 chairs were placed into that space. He had no doubt that Grifoni would somehow make the lieutenant regret his actions. She was Neapolitan, so it would happen. It would take some time, but it would happen. Brunetti smiled at the thought. He closed the door when he entered his office and took out his telefonino. From memory, he had never written it down, he dialed the number of his dealer friend, who answered with his name.
"Good morning, Manrico,"
Brunetti said, with the affection he could not help feeling for this man, at least for part of him. He was reluctant to let that part of him dominate the conversation, so he kept his voice cool and asked pointedly,
"How's Bruno?"
"Ah, dottore," Manrico
said, recognizing the voice after all this time.
"Tragedy has struck my family."
The words wept, but the tone of voice chirped.
"I hope it's a happy tragedy," Brunetti replied.
"The happiest. Bruno's getting married. In July."
"And the girl's father's a policeman?" Brunetti asked.
"Ah, far worse than that,"
Manrico answered in somber tones.
"Tell me."
"She's Scottish."
"No," Brunetti allowed himself to gasp.
"And Protestant?"
"Oh, that doesn't matter any more, commissario. But there's more."
"What?" "She's a doctor."
"Your son's marrying a professional woman who's Scottish?"
Brunetti made a long, deep humming noise.
"I can understand your pain, Manrico."
"Thank you, dottore. I knew you would."
Then, as if to prove that he was not really a clown, Manrico said,
"Since you began by mentioning Bruno, I suppose you want to remind me that I owe you a favor."
"I've never done it before, Manrico," Brunetti said, as though he felt obliged to defend his reputation.
"Not in 6 years." "7. What is it?"
"I'd like to know who's in charge of the Albertini."
"I assume you're not speaking of the Preside."
Manrico's voice had lost all sense of fun or raillery.
"No, I'm not," Brunetti answered.
Silence. Brunetti clutched his phone tighter and commanded himself not to speak. He walked to the window and looked down at the dock where Foa stood, wiping the railings of the police launch.
"This your official phone?"
Manrico asked.
"Yes."
"Then I'm afraid you'll have to wait until you get home tonight,"
the dealer said in such a serious voice that Brunetti was prepared for him to hang up without explaining. But then Manrico's usual cheerfulness returned, and he said,
"One more thing, commissario."
"Yes?"
"The wedding's the 15th. If I send you an invitation, will you come?"
Even his long pause sounded happy.
"Will it be here?"
Brunetti asked, hoping the answer would be no, because then he could legitimately refuse.
"No. It's at her father's church."
"Does that mean what I think it does, Manrico? That things are really that bad?"
"That's right, commissario. Only it's worse. Her father's a bishop."
Brunetti congratulated Manrico again, wished him many grandchildren, and hung up. He couldn't wait to tell Grifoni. But first he went to see Signorina Elettra, and found her standing at the window. After Grifoni's tiny cubicle, Signorina Elettra's office seemed enormous, especially because of the 3 windows on 1 wall. Much of the room was taken up by her desk, on which stood a computer, and a table, which he had never known to hold anything save a large bouquet of flowers, as was the case today, and the current copy of Vogue, also there. She turned towards him when he came in. What light the day was willing to offer came from behind her, so he could not see her expression, but her posture, what he sometimes thought of as her aura, seemed tired and heavy-burdened.
"Bon dì," Brunetti said.
I came down to see if you'd had time to take a look at Gasparini.
With a brief nod, Signorina Elettra returned to her desk. She sat and hit a few keys, summoned up a page, and glanced at it, saying,
"There isn't very much about him. He's an auditor for a chemical company. Works in Verona. His residence is listed in Santa Croce, near San Stai. Name and number in the phone book. His name doesn't appear in any police record in the Veneto, and I can't find a trace of him on social media."
She looked at Brunetti and added,
"It's strange the way a person seems non-existent if he's not on any social media, isn't it?"
Brunetti, who was not on any of them, just as Paolo was not, answered,
"I suppose so."
"There was no mention of a wife," she confessed.
"Professoressa Crosera."
"I don't know her first name," Brunetti said automatically.
"She teaches architecture at the university, and is a consultant in urban design, whatever that is, in Turkey and somewhere else."
Her eyes widened, as though she had to see more of him in order to believe that he could manage to find something she had failed to find.
"How did you learn that?"
"I asked her," Brunetti said laconically, then smiled and inquired, "Is that cheating?"
"Probably not,"
Signorina Elettra had the honesty to answer.
"It's just that it seems an old-fashioned way to get information."
"But you checked the phone book for Gasparini, didn't you?" Brunetti countered.
"Yes,"
she admitted.
"Online, though."
Disappointment made him ask,
"That's all you found?"
"That's all I found for the moment."
"If you have time, could you take a look at the wife as well?"
he asked, trying to make it sound as though there were some sense in doing it. Changing his tone, he said,
"I asked Vianello to call the papers and ask them to put the usual appeal for witnesses in their stories. It might have some effect."
Her right hand was halfway to the keyboard of her computer, but she paused and waved it vaguely in the air, then said,
"You know people don't like to get involved with us."
For a moment she looked beyond him, as though checking something written on the wall, and added,
"Not just us. The state, in any way."
She went on, her voice tentative, as though she had to speak this through before she'd understand what it was she wanted to say.
"The contract's been broken between us and the state, or been dissolved, but no one wants to make the news public. We know there's no contract anymore, and they know we know. They don't care what we want or have any real interest in what happens to us or in what we want."
She turned to him and shrugged, then smiled.
"And there's nothing we can do."
Brunetti was astonished to hear spoken what he had so often thought himself. Without pausing to think, he said,
"It can't be as bad as that."
She turned away from him and looked at the screen, as though she'd lost interest in what he had to say, or didn't agree with him but didn't think it worth the trouble to talk about it. He went back to his office, musing on the fact that both he and Signorina Elettra worked for this unresponsive, negligent state. Because he'd been awake since 2, Brunetti decided to treat himself well and walked down to Alcovo for lunch. On the way back, he gave thanks, as he always did, that the restaurant was only 10 minutes from the Questura and never failed to send him back a new and happier man. Unfortunately, this new man was confronted with old problems. He called Professoressa Crosera's telefonino, but was told to leave a message. He called the hospital and received no information about Gasparini. He called Gasparini's home number every hour, but the phone rang unanswered. Finally, at about 5, he decided he had no choice but to pass by the hospital on his way home, and called Grifoni to tell her where he was going. He might as well have saved himself the effort. Professoressa Crosera was in her husband's room, but when he went in and said good evening, she held her finger to her lips and pointed to her husband, lying now in a proper hospital bed. Brunetti indicated the door and the corridor beyond, but she shook her head and did not speak. Brunetti knew there was no likelihood that